first speaker this afternoon is Derek Turner. He is a professor in the philosophy department at Connecticut College. He is the author of two books that are very relevant to our colloquium today. First is Paleontology, A Philosophical Introduction, published with Cambridge in 2011. And he's also author of Making Prehistory, Historical Science and the Scientific Realism Debate, published in 2007 with Cambridge. Professor Turner will be speaking to us today on the very important topic that we need to get straight on before we can do anything else this afternoon, and that is, what is a fossil? So please join me in welcoming Professor Turner.
Great. Thank you, Elisa, for the invitation to be here today. It's nice that we have a colloquium on philosophy of paleontology. It's awesome. It's nice to have a chance to connect with Caitlin and Adrian and Patrick also. So it's really great to be here. Unfortunately, the message of my talk today might be that we're not really all that clear on what a fossil is. So I want to say just a little bit to start with about philosophical motivations. I think the concept of a fossil is pretty significant because it helps delineate the disciplinary turf of paleontology. We tend to think of paleontology as the study of fossils, whatever else it's about. Knowing what a fossil is... Oh, sorry, I'll lean in a little bit. Yep. Knowing what a fossil is might help us to... to be clear about the disciplinary subject matter of paleontology. I'm also in thinking about these issues. I'm trying to channel Martin Rudwick a little bit. I really appreciate his book from the early 70s, The Meaning of Fossils, where he really charts, by looking at several episodes in history of paleontology, charts how significant changes in paleontology, theoretical changes in paleontology, went hand in hand with rethinking what fossils were all about. And that history, I think, is really, really interesting. One thing I'm going to try to suggest today is that even though we've made a lot of progress in paleontology, the concept itself is still pretty muddy, as it was right at the very beginning, in the 1500s, which is where Rudwick begins his story. For myself, I first started thinking about these issues when I considered a thought experiment. I was really trying to think about paleontology's contributions to evolutionary theory, right? How much does paleontology really have to contribute? And I thought an interesting way of getting into that issue was to consider this thought experiment where I imagined a planet just like ours, but sans fossils, a kind of twist of the old creationist idea that God or Satan stuck the fossils in the rocks to tempt our faith. I thought, well, imagine that God removes the fossils. What would evolutionary biology look like on a planet with no fossils? There might be all kinds of interesting things that evolutionary biologists could figure out, but would there be limitations? In what way would they be hampered by the absence of having a fossil record on this planet that I sort of... Maybe this is kind of silly. I was calling it a fossilia, but one pitfall of doing thought experiments in philosophy is that when you ask about the detail, when you start thinking about the details, things can quickly start to slip through your fingers. And this happened to me here. I still think it's kind of a cool thought experiment, but as I started to think about, okay, what exactly would scientists on this imaginary planet be deprived of, I had a very tough time. The first one early question that occurred to me is like, well, would there be fossil fuels on Aphosilia? Well, if not, that's a pretty different place. And I started, these kind of questions kept occurring to me. So there are two main claims that I want to defend. And the first claim is that the concept of fossil is actually pretty confused. We really don't have a good story to tell about what fossils are. And I'm going to spend the bulk of the talk today presenting a bunch of cases to try to really sow some confusion. And really, I'm going to focus on defending the first claim for the most part. I'm going to spend a little bit less time on the second claim. I think it needs a lot more attention than I'm going to be able to give it here. But in my last few slides, I'm going to take a couple minutes to share a few thoughts about it. But the the bulk of what I'll say will really address the first question. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about the second issue in Q&A. But I really, I am convinced that our concept of a fossil is pretty confused. What I'm not sure about is whether that's a problem. In fact, my second suggestion here is that it might not be. This might be a case of tolerable confusion in our scientific concepts. You know, we philosophers always have, we have this hang-up. We always want to clarify, and the thought is that might, in some cases, take us in the wrong direction. There might be cases where a certain amount of confusion is perfectly okay. It doesn't interfere with the relevant scientific work. So that's kind of the suggestion here. But like I said, I'm going to focus mainly on the first claim. So just to give a bit of an outline, I think there are in all 7 sources of confusion about what fossils are. I'm going to spend a little time to start with on this issue of pseudo-fossils, which I think is really interesting. We'll discuss a couple cases there. A second worry is that the term fossil does not pick out a natural kind. A third worry, you might think, well, even if the term fossil doesn't pick out a natural kind, it might still be possible to come up with some plausible necessary conditions for something being a fossil. Maybe. I'm a little worried about that, too. I think I'm going to give an example of one really initially plausible necessary condition I think runs into some trouble. So I think that's an issue as well. When you talk to paleontologists, they'll sometimes mention an age cutoff. They'll say fossils have to be older than 10,000 years, something like that. I'm a little worried about that sort of age cutoff. We'll look at that in some detail. I think it's a little bit tough sometimes to distinguish literal from metaphorical usage. It's not always clear whether we're talking about something that's literally a fossil or whether we're just kind of extending that concept metaphorically in some interesting way. And then I think there's some interesting problem cases. A favorite, recently discovered favorite case of mine is ambergris. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I think it's completely fascinating. And then a final problem concerning kind of the nature of casting and molding processes. So I'm going to sort of just give some examples that highlight all 7 of these issues, and hopefully at the end everybody will be somewhat confused about this. So we're going to start with a really fun case. I was reading, my mother actually sent me over the summer an article about this. Auction house of I.M. Chait in Los Angeles auctioned off this item right here, which was advertised as a coprolite, so a fossilized feces, right? And this was the language, this was the listing from the auction house. This truly spectacular specimen is possibly the longest example of coprolite ever to be offered at auction. Boasts a wonderfully even pale brown yellow. I can't even read this. Coloring with a terrifically detailed texture to the heavily botryoidal surface across the whole of its immense length. The passer of this remarkable object is unknown, but it's nonetheless a highly evocative specimen of unprecedented size, presented in 4 sections, each with a heavy black marble custom base, because that's really important, and eye-watering 40 inches in length overall. And this was auctioned off. Actually, the price, the bidder paid $8,500, but including commission, it came to $10,370. So, yeah. The item was, we think, about 6 million years old. It came from Miocene rocks in Washington State near the town of Toledo. And it's a site, it's a place called the Wilkes Formation, and it's produced a lot of similar objects over the years. One obvious question is, who did it? This is actually really a pretty fascinating question. Some people have suggested an alligator or a turtle. This was a wetland, swampy area during the Miocene 6-7 million years ago. But the mammals that you would have had, it's not clear it's just not clear who could have left an item like this. You can also buy. This is just for fun. You can also buy a coprolite. I discovered there are these fossil dealers, and you can buy, these are smaller ones from the same Wilkes Formation. And people make jewelry out of them, which is pretty interesting. I don't know. But the paleontologists and geologists who've looked at this are, a couple of them who've looked into this are pretty sure that the buyer, the private collector who paid $10,000 for this thing, got ripped off. And this is where the story gets a little bit interesting, I think. This is a quotation from a paper, 2001. Excrement-shaped masses of siderite and limonite have been reported from clear sedimentary rocks that range in age from late Permian to Holocene. These objects have been widely accepted as being coprolites, but the ferruginous composition, absence of internal inclusions, and scarcity of assorted vertebrate remains suggest that they may instead be pseudo-fossils created by mechanical deformation of plastic sediment. So these things are pseudo-fossils. And this is from an even earlier paper by a scientist at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, Patrick Spencer, who actually studied this, the Wilkes Formation stuff pretty extensively in the early 90s. And he came up with this rival hypothesis, which is these things don't, they're not coprolites at all. What happened is you had, you know, rotting and decaying trees in this swampy wetland area get buried with volcanic ash and sediment and silt and stuff. And then under pressure, this stuff gets kind of squirted out through knot holes in the rotted trees, kind of like toothpaste squirting out of the tube of toothpaste. This is the thought. And from what I've been able to discern, most, you know, the scientists have looked at this think that something like this is pretty plausible. So, and this is a quotation from, you know, a summer news piece, but it's a quotation offered by the same scientist, Patrick Spencer. He says, he was talking about the one that was auctioned off, the 40-inch coprolite in scare quotes. He says, I'd make a thin section to see if there's any residue in there from the last meal. I've done it with enough of them, and I haven't found a dang thing in there. I've written more than a few letters to fossil supply houses and asked them to stop selling them as coprolites, but they clearly continue to do so. But now, the thing that actually interests me about this case is the thought that these things are pseudo-fossils, right? That seems to be the consensus, and Musto, the scientist quoted just a moment ago, actually calls them pseudo-fossils. And there are, you know, lots of really interesting examples of pseudo-fossils. Most of the paradigm cases of them have inorganic origins. This is just a quick example of something of dendrites where you have, I think in this case it might be manganese oxide or something like that, you get oxidation on the surface of a rock and creates these kind of cool, you know, plant-like patterns. It's not a plant fossil at all, but it looks like one. And so in the paradigm cases, you have something with inorganic origins that looks like it has organic origins. I call it a pseudo-fossil. But, you know, I started thinking, I'll talk about this other case in a second, but I started thinking about it, and even if the skeptics are right about, you know, the coprolites in scare quotes, they still have organic origins, right? They would just be trace fossils from trees, right? So here's another interesting case. Dinococcalea, the terrible snail, was found in southern England in 1921. These big fossils, there's one specimen, the biggest one was 2.2 meters long. The first person who described these classified them as snails and suggested that it was the largest snail ever to have lived. Very quickly, though, these were dismissed as pseudo-fossils. There's a whole bunch of problems with the interpretation of these things as snails. There's no clear aperture at the end. There seemed to be too much size variation. You know, if it was one species of snail, you'd expect a smaller degree of variation in size. The sizes of these things were all over the place. You had the chirality was weird. Here you had both clockwise spiraling and counterclockwise spiraling ones, whereas if they were really snails, you would have expected them to be more uniform. So really quickly, scientists realized that these are probably not snails. And a consensus emerged that they're pseudo-fossils. But then, really interestingly, The most recent work on this case I've been able to find suggested, well, actually, they might, they're not snails, but they might still have organic origins. So this paper by Taylor and Sandino suggests that these things might be concretions, you know, just geological concretions that formed around the burrows of small worms. And they did some, this is just a little bit of computer modeling that they did to kind of show how the concretion might form around a, you know, a very thin burrow that you might start with. And I find this case in particular really, really fascinating, because if this is right, these structures are still, you know, they look like classic trace fossils. I mean, in other cases where we have, you know, preserved burrows in the fossil record, we call them trace fossils. But they also, they kind of look like paradigm cases of pseudo-fossils, because geological concretions, a lot of classic cases of pseudo-fossils are geological concretions that look like remains of living organisms but aren't really. And I think this case fits that description as well, you know. You know, it's a geological concretion, kind of looks like a big snail, but it's not. I'm just sort of wondering what to make of this. You know, should we distinguish between authentic pseudo-fossils and pseudo-fossils that, in spite of how they look, actually turn out to have organic origins? Like, what's going on with pseudo-fossils? Could a pseudo-fossil, could something be a pseudo-fossil and also be a trace fossil? You know, I'm sort of curious about these, what to say about these sorts of cases. So that's one source of confusion. Another issue, and I suspect this probably won't be too controversial, but I think the term fossil does not pick out a natural kind on any conception of what a natural kind might be. There are just so many different kinds of processes that can lead to the production of what we would consider to be fossils, and in a lot of cases those processes have very little to do with each other. So the image on the upper left up there is a petrified tree stump from fluorescent fossil beds in Colorado. And that was created by permineralization. What happened was you had a forest. It was buried in a volcanic lahar at a certain point. And the volcanic material is about 14, 15 feet deep, and the trees, every part of the tree that stuck up above that just rotted away and decayed. The stuff that was buried got preserved via permineralization with, silicas and stuff like that coming in from the volcanic material and kind of filling in the pores in the wood. And that's a completely different process from casting and molding. This is an image from Dinosaur State Park in Connecticut, one of my favorite places, where you've got really nice remains of dinosaur tracks, where the trackway creates, you know, the dinosaur's footprints create a mold that then gets later filled in by sediment. And this last image is also from fluorescent fossil beds, a completely different kind of process. This is a preservation of an insect. It dies, it falls to the bottom of a lake, sediments pile up on top of it, it gets crushed and compressed. Most of the organic material decays, leaving some carbon, right? You get this beautiful, exquisite image. But these processes have very little to do with each other. This makes me think that the whole sort of notion of fossilization is kind of a grab bag. It's very, very different sorts of processes. And even if you just focus on trace fossils, there are lots of different ways in which trace fossils can get preserved. You get very traditional kinds of fossilized burrows. There are other examples that I'm really interested in. So chemofossils is a really interesting category. I think part of what's going on here is new kinds of technology and new ways of studying the historical record are actually putting pressure on our ways of thinking about what fossils are. Chemofossils are just chemical biomarkers in the geological record, and this is a paper on sponges. You know, the oldest fossil sponges in the traditional kind of fossil in the fossil record are 500 some million years ago, 540 million, something like that. But scientists have gone and found chemical biomarkers, sterols, associated with the decay of sponges that you can identify using the geological record. And they go back a lot further. They put the origin of sponges about 80 million years earlier than the traditional fossil record does. And a lot of scientists call these chemofossils, just sort of chemical biomarkers in the record. This is another interesting example. I'm not quite sure what to think about this, but this is a case of banded iron formations that they don't contain fossils at all in the traditional sense, but they do record biological activity, right? So these were created when blue-green algae very early in the Earth's history started cranking out tons and tons of oxygen into the oceans, and that's what permitted the formation of these iron-rich formations on the ocean floor. So we look at that, you don't see anything that looks like a fossil in the traditional sense, but it's still a geological trace of biological activity. So this is a classic example of a failure to be a natural kind. Jade, consists of two different minerals, jadeite, nephrite, that have different properties. It's not a perfect analogy, but I think the concept of fossil fails to pick out a natural kind in somewhat the same way that the concept of jade does. I want to say just a bit about living fossils as well, because I want to think about now possible necessary conditions for something being a fossil. Living fossils, I think it's safe to say, are not really fossils, right? They're, just living things that we happen upon that look a lot like preserved remains that we have in the fossil records. A favorite example is the Wallamai pine from Australia that was discovered not too long ago, I think in the 90s maybe. It sort of just happened upon, and the living trees look really just like these fossils that we have from the Mesozoic. People sometimes call it the dinosaur tree. It's just a nice example of a living fossil. Another favorite example is just cycads. This is a picture I took of a cycad at some point. This is neither here nor there, but one of the actually this might be the only case of a national monument that closed was Fossil Cycad National Monument. They closed it in the 50s because people had walked off with all the fossil cycads. It's kind of a sad story. But it's another case of a living fossil where, we have these lovely fossil cycads, from the Mesozoic. And morphologically, living cycads are not too much different. So this looks like and we could give tons of other examples, this looks like a metaphorical extension of the concept of a fossil. I think it's pretty straightforward. But it's interesting to think about, why exactly living fossils, shouldn't count as genuine fossils. And I just wanted to consider a straightforward, intuitive proposal. Something's a fossil only if it's a geological item. It can't be a fossil if it doesn't belong to the geological record. Right? It's got to be a part of the rock record somehow. Right? That immediately rules out living fossils. Right? It's just initially, I think, intuitive, sort of plausible proposal. But there's some problems. It's not entirely clear what makes something a geological item. And fossilization is also a lengthy process that comes in degrees. We don't get the chance to watch that process happening from beginning to end, but there's a vagueness issue here, I think, if you look at the process by which biological material kind of gets fossilized and transformed into a geological item. And here again, I want to consider some problem cases. So think of the carcass of a woolly mammoth frozen in permafrost, right? Is that part of the geological record? It's not. It's what you might consider mostly unaltered remains. It's just frozen. It's not really chemically transformed, but it is buried, in permafrost. It's something that you have to dig up. This is just an image of a dog that was covered in volcanic ash in Pompeii, you know? Is that part of the geological record? I don't know. I don't know what to say about these cases. Bone breccia, this is an image of some, I think mostly Homo heidelbergensis bones from the bottom of a cave in Spain, Atapuerca cave in Spain. And, you know, they're just kind of piled up in sand and dirt, right? They're not, you know, you don't have any kind of process of mineral replacement going on like you have with dinosaur bones and stuff. So is that part of the geological record? Ambergris, I also want to dwell on as a fascinating case to think about. So ambergris, gray amber, you know, so-called, I think by analogy with regular yellow amber, you know, which is fossilized tree resin. This is a weird substance that people have used for centuries to make perfume. They use it as fixatives to make perfume. It's pretty valuable stuff. It's produced in the intestines of sperm whales. We think probably to ease the passage of the sharp objects, especially the beaks of giant squids that the sperm whales eat. And these things often contain squid beaks. If you find them and, you know, cut them up, you can find squid beaks. And for me, the really interesting thing about this case, well, you get the squid beak thing going on, but then these seem to undergo some transformation while they're floating around in the oceans before they wash up on shore. There's oxidation that happens. Exposure to sunlight and salt in the water kind of changes them a little bit. And so people say that sort of aged ambergris is quite a bit different from stuff that hasn't been out of the whale for quite as long. It's a really interesting sort of case. Apparently it turns gray and waxy as it floats around the oceans. And so, you know, is this part of the geological record? Maybe not. But I think, you know, the squid beaks, are those fossils? Fossil remains of the squids? You know, I'm not quite sure what to make of that case. So I gave a much earlier version of this talk to an audience at the University of Connecticut in the geosciences program there. And in that earlier version, I had not included much about, you know, an age cutoff, but there's a paleontologist in the audience who said, well, actually, you know, he's kind of interested in the problem cases, but it's actually, you know, when we were in graduate school, they all just told us that there was, you know, if it's older than a certain time, it's a fossil. If not, who cares? You know, it was a sort of a, I can't remember if he he wasn't exactly defending this. He was just reporting that this is what he was brought up with. I can't remember if it was a 10,000-year cutoff or something shorter, but this is just one example of a definition I came across, a fossil. It's a little bit out of date, but you get the idea. And I love the ambivalence in this. A fossil is the remains of ancient life, but it's not practical to define a minimum age limit for fossils. And nevertheless, about 10,000 years before present is often taken as an arbitrary dividing line between what is fossil and what's recent. Sometimes even when you see definitions of paleontology, you can see people saying paleontologists study living things that occurred prior to the Holocene and stuff like that, and this fits with that. But I worry a lot about... So this has the advantage of ruling out a whole bunch of these cases. So ambergris is not going to count as a fossil on this sort of case. This explains why living fossils are not fossils. But I worry about the arbitrariness, as we'll see in a second. But I think one other reason for having... I think you need a cutoff like this, because if you just... You know, one approach you could take is just say, well, the concept of fossils is an epistemic or an evidential concept. You know, anything that gives us evidence of prehistoric life is a fossil, right? I feel the pull of that. I find that kind of appealing, but that has weird consequences. I mean, if that's true, then we're all fossils. And aphocele, you know, think about the planet aphocele, it wouldn't really have any life on it. All living things are carrying around information about, earlier forms of life. We're carrying it, you know, in our genetic material. We're carrying it, if you just look at our traits, adaptations that we're carrying around with give evidence of past operation of natural selection and so on. So you need something. It seems like you need something to avoid that weird result that that we're all fossils. That would be a strange thing to say. And the 10,000 year cutoff does that job, but it also has weird consequences. And I think you really get into this when you think about ancient DNA research and paleogenomics, which is really an interesting area to look at. It's kind of taken off in the last 10 or 15 years. You know, we can sequence the DNA from extinct organisms. We can do it using hair samples from mammoth carcasses that are older than 10,000 years, 15, 20,000 years. We can sequence their DNA. We can, you know, scientists have worked on genetic material obtained from the bones and teeth of cave bears, you know, caves in Austria that are, you know, 50,000 years old. You can do this with Neanderthal bones, right? Tens of thousands of years old. And so all on the usual age cutoff, all that stuff counts as being part of the fossil record. Right? But you can do exactly the same thing with younger specimens. Right? A century old or so. And, you know, the methods are the same, and the nature of the material that you're studying is the same. It just hasn't maybe degraded quite as much in the younger specimens. But in both cases, the DNA that you're sequencing, that you're looking at, it's really a kind of unaltered biological remain, right? It's also not clear to me that in paleogenomics, you're really studying anything that's in the geological record. I'm not quite sure what to say about that issue either. It's a recur to that earlier source of confusion. So I think the you know, 10,000 year cutoff, any kind of age cutoff like that, really is going to be somewhat arbitrary. And this is just a logical consequence of that. You know, if you have an age cutoff, then you end up saying that this genetic material didn't start out as a fossil, but it became a fossil, you know, once it aged a certain amount or something like that, even if you don't have that much transformation of the material going on. So we've got a couple of issues so far. Fossil doesn't pick out a natural kind. You know, being part, it's hard to make sense of the idea that being part of the geological record is necessary for being a fossil, right? The age cutoff seems both something we need, but something that's kind of arbitrary and tough to defend. There are also, I think, some challenges in thinking about whether we're using the term fossil literally or metaphorically. This is another kind of issue that I'm interested in. There's some clear cases of each, so, you know, in the familiar paradigm cases, you know, we're using the term literally. Living fossils are fossils by metaphorical extension, at best, I think. Unless you do want to bite the bullet and say that we're all, I guess one could do that, you could say that we're all fossils, and living fossils are, they're both literal and metaphorical fossils. You could say that if you wanted to. I'm especially interested in some of these other cases, molecular fossils. Are those, when we talk about molecular fossils in the context of ancient DNA research, which is increasingly common, is that metaphorical usage of the term fossil, or are these things literally fossils? I'm not completely sure what to say about that. Chemofossils, I'm probably more inclined to say that they're literally trace fossils, but even there, I'm not completely sure. It's a new term. It's a new usage. And there might be some question about whether it's literal or metaphorical term. Another case I've run across that I think it's worth puzzling over. It's a little bit of a peripheral case. It might not matter that much, but I think it's interesting to puzzle over fossil water. Geologists do talk about this. Sometimes water that's locked up in aquifers is sometimes referred to as fossil water. And when they say this, they're really evoking an analogy with fossil fuels. Right? And, you know, I actually think the term fossil fuels is kind of interesting. It actually goes, you know, Rudwick in his work on this points out that the term fossil originally meant just anything you dug up out of the ground, which could have included all kinds of stuff that we today would not consider to be fossils. The term fossil fuels kind of picks up on that earlier usage of the term fossil. And I think fossil water does too. And it's an interesting case. It has inorganic origins. You know, the Ogallala Aquifer is basically glacial runoff, glacial meltwater, got trapped in this gravelly layer in the Midwest. I just to pose some questions about this case, is this a metaphorical usage when we talk about fossil water, or is fossil water really fossil? It's just that when you apply the term fossil in that case, you're just using it in a different sense. You know, what you mean there is fossil is a sort of non-renewable resource that you dig up out of the ground or something like that. Is it like a localized sense of fossil, or is this more of a metaphorical thing? Interestingly, I think it also, fossil water is actually not too far away from some of our examples of pseudo-fossils. It looks like something that really has organic origins. It resembles things that have organic origins, but has inorganic origins. So, again, kind of a peripheral case. I wouldn't want to ask this case to do much argumentative work, but it's kind of interesting to think about. This is just for fun. As I started thinking more about this stuff, I kept running across other examples. There are actually lots of interesting parallels between historical linguistics and evolutionary biology, evolutionary theory and stuff. This is one thing that comes up. There are these fossil words that we still use, but only in the context of certain phrases, right? So my favorite one is being hoisted on your own petard, which is a grenade, I think, an old-fashioned term for a grenade, or I think. You might check me on that. Is that right? Oh, what is it?
Stabbing.
Stabbing? Oh, yeah, maybe that's it. Okay, I got it wrong. Okay, yeah. We don't use the word petard anywhere else, you know, as my cluelessness about this reveals. Except in that kind of context, right? So, this seems like it's pretty clearly metaphorical, usage, but. One last issue that I've been thinking about is the problem of multiple castes, right? I'd be curious to hear what folks think about this. I'm not quite sure what to think about it. But this is an image of the Carnegie Diplodocus. It's an early example of a fossil where casts was made of it. Many casts were made of it and sent around to other museums around the world. When you make a cast of a fossil, is the object you've made also a fossil, or is it just a kind of copy of it? I'm not quite sure. It's an artificial process, right? The making of a cast of a fossil, but it's actually not completely dissimilar from the casting and molding process that leads to the creation of lots of fossils in the first place. So I think that's worth thinking about. I've been looking for information about this. I've had trouble finding a good case to use, but I've once heard a paleontologist suggest that you could actually have multiple casting and molding processes go on in nature, right? Where you have imagine a shell or something like that, where you get a mold created, and then, you know, the shell itself dissolves and, you know, gets replaced with inorganic material. You get cast, right? And then something happens to the mold, but the cast persists, and then a new mold gets created later on, right? That you could have multiple steps in this kind of process. I think it's a question, if you could have that kind of multiple casting and molding process going on in nature, you know, if humans are doing it, should that impact whether we call the products fossils or not? Lots of questions. This is sort of where I'm at, and I think I'm concerned that we just don't really have a terribly good definition of fossil here. And I now want to take the last couple minutes of the talk and just consider some responses to this. Like, suppose everything I've said is right. You know, is this really a case of considerable conceptual confusion? What do we make of that? I think there's one dismissive response that one could have, which is to say, well, you know, fossil is not even really that interesting of a theoretical term. In other cases, think of the concept of species or the concept of fitness. We've got terms that figure centrally in evolutionary theory, we really need clarity with respect to those terms. In the case of fossil, it's sort of like, you know, there's not that much at stake in a case like this. I'm worried that this response, I mean, my own thinking is not too far away from this, but I'm worried that this might be a little bit too dismissive. Because I actually do think paleontologists theorize about fossils. You know, taphonomists study the fossilization process and make generalizations about how fossilization works. Term fossil figures in those generalizations. Fossilization is an unobservable process. We can replicate parts of it, aspects of it, experimentally, but you know, the kind of fossilization processes that we're really interested in, we can't observe. So I actually think it might be a more of a theoretical term than it seems. Other possible responses, I see really two ways to go. One is to work hard to try to clean up the conceptual confusion. And this is what philosophers of science typically do. In all of these other cases, you know, species fitness, the concept of function in biology, there are lots of other cases where philosophers have done a lot of work to try to distinguish different senses of a term. Often people make pluralist moves and they say, well, this sense is appropriate in this context, this other sense is appropriate in this other context. The other option, it seems to me, is to just tolerate or even embrace the confusion, the muddiness of the concept, and just, you know, we don't know what fossils are. That's not such a problem. I want to kind of move towards maybe this second claim, but in a way that's less dismissive than the response I suggested just a moment ago. To start with, and here I'm really just gesturing in arguments, just to kind of hint at where things might go. But you know, we definitely could clarify the concept of fossil with some work. We could bite bullets. You know, one could defend a broad view that any presently observable evidence of past life is a fossil. I mean, that would involve some bullet biting, but you know, one could do it. One could insist that belonging to the geological record is necessary for being a fossil, and then, you know, try to dig in and figure and defend further views about what actually counts as belonging to the geological record. You know, one could do that work if one wanted to. But I'm not completely sure that the payoff is really worth it. My own leanings on this are that this is actually a really interesting case where we don't really need clarity. If you look at the kind of work that paleontologists actually do with fossils, very little of it actually requires a clear conception of what fossils are. A lot of it is looking at large samples of fossil data, trying to infer process from pattern. And you know, you don't really need to eliminate all the various kinds of confusion that I pointed to in order to do that kind of work. What you really need is just a lot of data. So when you look at the practice of paleontology, it might turn out that there's unclarity here that we can live with. And then this, I want to conclude with an analogy. It's not perfect, but I'm hoping it's kind of suggestive. I think this case might be a little bit like the case of the definition of life. The analogy is not quite right for various reasons, but I think the concept of a living thing helps to delineate the turf of biology in general, in somewhat the same way the concept of a fossil works to delineate the turf of paleontology. There are, however, relatively few scientific contexts where you really need to know what a living thing is. You know, astrobiology is one. People who work on the definition of life, they kind of get interested in astrobiology and stuff. But for most purposes, you don't really need to worry about how to define life in biology. I want to suggest maybe the concept of fossils is a little bit like that. It's an important concept. It has a kind of disciplinary centrality, but we can live with a lot of unclarity about what fossils are. Okay? So, thanks.